Chapter 27. Our dear brother, Ata Chan, the lawyer's wrinkled hand as he stands in the dark room, irresolute, makes him start and say, "What's that?" "It's me," returns the old man of the house, whose breath is in his ear. "Can't you wake him?" "No." "What have you done with your candle?" "It's gone out." "Here it is." Crook takes it, goes to the fire, stoops over the red embers, and tries to get a light. The dying ashes have no light to spare, and his endeavors are vain. Muttering, after an ineffectual call to his lodger, that he will go downstairs, and bring a lighted candle from the shop, the old man departs. Mr. Tulkinghorn, for some new reason that he has, does not await his return in the room, but on the stairs outside. The welcome light soon shines upon the wall, as Crook comes slowly up with his green-eyed cat following at his heels. "Does the man generally sleep like this?" inquired the lawyer in a low voice. I don't know," says Crook, shaking his head and lifting his eyebrows. "I know next to nothing of his habits, except that he keeps himself very close." Thus whispering, they both go in together. As the light goes in, the great eyes in the shutters, darkening, seem too close. Not so the eyes upon the bed. "God save us!" exclaims Mr. Tulkinghorn. "He is dead." Crook drops the heavy hand he has taken up so suddenly that the arm swings over the bedside. They look at one another for a moment. "Send for some doctor. Call for Miss Flight up the stairs, sir. Here's poison by the bed. Call out for Flight, will you?" says Crook, with his lean hand spread out above the body like a vampire's wings. Mr. Tulkinghorn hurries to the landing and calls, "Miss Flight. Flight. Make haste, here, whoever you are. Flight." Crook follows him with his eyes, and while he is calling, finds opportunity to steal to the old portmanteau and steal back again. "Run, Flight, run. The nearest doctor. Run." So Mr. Crook addresses a crazy little woman who is his female lodger, who appears and vanishes in a breath, who soon returns accompanied by a testy medical man brought from his dinner, with a broad, snuffy upper lip and a broad Scotch tongue. "Eh, bless the heart, so ye," says the medical man, looking up at them after a moment's examination. "He's just as dead as fairy." Mr. Tulkinghorn, standing by the old portmanteau, inquires if he has been dead any time. "Any time, sir?" says the medical gentleman. "It's probable he will have been dead about 3 hours." "About that time, I should say," observes a dark young man on the other side of the bed. "Are you in the medical profession yourself, sir?" inquires the first. The dark young man says yes. "Then I'll just take my departure," replies the other, "for I'm nae good here." With which remark he finishes his brief attendance, and returns to finish his dinner. The dark young surgeon passes the candle across and across the face, and carefully examines the law writer, who has established his pretensions to his name, by becoming indeed no one. "I knew this person by sight very well," says he. "He has purchased opium of me for the last year and a half." "Was anybody present related to him?" glancing round upon the three bystanders. "I was his landlord," grimly answers Crook, taking the candle from the surgeon's outstretched hand. "He told me once I was the nearest relation he had." "He has died," says the surgeon, "of an overdose of opium, there is no doubt. The room is strongly flavored with it. There is enough here now," taking an old teapot from Mr. Crook, "to kill a dozen people." "Do you think he did it on purpose?" asks Crook. "Took the overdose?" "Yes." Crook almost smacks his lips with the unction of a horrible interest. "I can't say. I should think it unlikely, as he has been in the habit of taking so much. But nobody can tell. He was very poor, I suppose?" "I suppose he was. His room don't look rich," says Crook, who might have changed eyes with his cat, as he casts his sharp glance around. "But I have never been in it since he had it, and he was too close to name his circumstances to me." "Did he owe you any rent?" "6 weeks." He will never pay it, says the young man, resuming his examination. It is beyond a doubt that he is indeed as dead as Pharaoh, and to judge from his appearance and condition, I should think it a happier lease. Yet he must have been a good figure when a youth, and I dare say, good looking. He says this, not unfeelingly, while sitting on the bedstead's edge with his face towards that other face, and his hand upon the region of the heart. I recollect once thinking there was something in his manner, uncouth as it was, that denoted a fallen life. Was that so? He continues, looking round. Crook replies, you might as well ask me to describe the ladies whose heads of hair I have got in sacks downstairs. Than that he was my lodger for a year and a half and lived, or didn't live by law writing, I know no more of him. During this dialogue Mr. Tulkinghorn has stood aloof by the old portmanteau, with his hands behind him, equally removed, to all appearance, from all three kinds of interest exhibited near the bed, from the young surgeon's professional interest in death, noticeable as being quite apart from his remarks on the deceased as an individual, from the old man's unction, and the little crazy woman's awe. His imperturbable face has been as inexpressive as his rusty clothes. One could not even say he has been thinking all this while. He has shown neither patience nor impatience, nor attention nor abstraction. He has shown nothing but his shell. As easily might the tone of a delicate musical instrument be inferred from its case, as the tone of Mr. Tulkinghorn from his case. He now interposes, addressing the young surgeon in his unmoved professional way. I looked in here, he observes, just before you, with the intention of giving this deceased man, whom I never saw alive, some employment at his trade of copying. I had heard of him from my stationer Snagsby of Cook's Court. Since no one here knows anything about him, it might be as well to send for Snagsby. Ah! To the little crazy woman, who has often seen him in court, and whom he has often seen, and who proposes, in frightened dumb show, to go for the law stationer. Suppose you do. While she is gone, the surgeon abandons his hopeless investigation, uncovers its subject with the patchwork counterpane. Mr. Crook and he interchange a word or two. Mr. Tulkinghorn says nothing, but stands, ever, near the old portmanteau. Mr. Snagsby arrives hastily in his gray coat and his black sleeves. Dear me, he says, and it has come to this, has it? Bless my soul! Can you give the person of the house any information about this unfortunate creature, Snagsby? Inquires Mr. Tulkinghorn. He was in arrears with his rent, it seems. And he must be buried, you know. Well, sir, says Mr. Snagsby, coughing his apologetic cough behind his hand, I really don't know what advice I could offer, except sending for the beadle. I don't speak of advice, returns Mr. Tulkinghorn. I could advise no one better, sir, I am sure, says Mr. Snagsby, with his deferential cough. I speak of affording some clue to his connections, or to where he came from, or to anything concerning him. I assure you, sir, says Mr. Snagsby, after prefacing his reply with his cough of general propitiation, that I no more know where he came from than I know where he has gone to, perhaps, suggests the surgeon to help him out. A pause. Mr. Tulkinghorn looking at the law stationer. Mr. Crook, with his mouth open, looking for somebody to speak next. As to his connections, sir, says Mr. Snagsby, if a person was to say to me, Snagsby, here's £20,000 down, ready for you in the Bank of England, if you'll only name one of 'em, I couldn't do it, sir. About a year and a half ago, to the best of my belief, at the time when he first came to lodge at the present Rag and Bottle shop, that was the time, says Crook with a nod. About a year and a half ago, says Mr. Snagsby, strengthened, he came into our place one morning after breakfast, and finding my little woman, which I name Mrs. Snagsby, when I use that appellation, in our shop, produced a specimen of his handwriting, and gave her to understand, that he was in want of copying work to do and was, not to put too fine a point upon it, a favorite apology for plain speaking with Mr. Snagsby, which he always offers with a sort of argumentative frankness, hard up. My little woman is not in general partial to strangers, particular not to put too fine a point upon it when they want anything. But she was rather took by something about this person, whether by his being unshaved, or by his hair, being in want of attention, or by what other lady's reasons, I leave you to judge, and she accepted of the specimen, and likewise of the address. My little woman hasn't a good ear for names, proceeds Mr. Snagsby, after consulting his cough of consideration behind his hand, and she considered Nemo equally the same as Nimrod. In consequence of which, she got into a habit of saying to me at meals, apostrophe Mr. Snagsby, you haven't found Nimrod any work yet. Apostrophe apostrophe or apostrophe Mr. Snagsby, why didn't you give that 8-and-30 chancery folio in Jarndyce to Nimrod? Apostrophe apostrophe or such like. And that is the way he gradually fell into job work at our place. And that is the most I know of him, except that he was a quick hand, and a hand not sparing of night work, and that if you gave him out, say, 5-and-40 folio on the Wednesday night, you would have it brought in on the Thursday morning. All of which, Mr. Snagsby concludes by politely motioning with his hat towards the bed, as much as to add, I have no doubt my honorable friend would confirm, if he were in a condition to do it. Hadn't you better see, says Mr. Tulkinghorn to Crook, whether he had any papers that may enlighten you? There will be an inquest, and you will be asked the question. You can read? No, I can't, returns the old man with a sudden grin. Snagsby, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, look over the room for him. He will get into some trouble or difficulty otherwise. Being here, I'll wait if you make haste, and then I can testify on his behalf, if it should ever be necessary, that all was fair and right. If you will hold the candle for Mr. Snagsby, my friend, he'll soon see whether there is anything to help you. In the first place, here's an old portmanteau, sir, says Snagsby. Ah, to be sure, so there is. Mr. Tulkinghorn does not appear to have seen it before, though he is standing so close to it, and though there is very little else, heaven knows. The marine store merchant holds the light, and the law stationer conducts the search. The surgeon leans against the corner of the chimney piece. Miss Flight peeps and trembles just within the door. The apt old scholar of the old school, with his dull black breeches tied with ribbons at the knees, his large black waistcoat, his long-sleeved black coat, and his wisp of limp white neckerchief tied in the bow the peerage knows so well, stands in exactly the same place and attitude. There are some worthless articles of clothing in the old portmanteau. There is a bundle of pawnbroker's duplicates, those turnpike tickets on the road of poverty. There is a crumpled paper, smelling of opium, on which are scrawled rough memoranda as, took, such a day, so many grains, took, such another day, so many more begun some time ago, as if with the intention of being regularly continued, but soon left off. There are a few dirty scraps of newspapers, all referring to coroner's inquests. There is nothing else. They search the cupboard and the drawer of the ink-splashed table. There is not a morsel of an old letter, or of any other writing in either. The young surgeon examines the dress on the law writer. A knife and some odd halfpence are all he finds. Mr. Snagsby's suggestion is the practical suggestion after all, and the beadle must be called in. So the little crazy lodger goes for the beadle, and the rest come out of the room. Don't leave the cat there, says the surgeon. That won't do. Mr. Crook therefore drives her out before him, and she goes furtively downstairs, winding her lithe tail and licking her lips. Good night, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, and goes home to allegory and meditation. By this time the news has got into the court. Groups of its inhabitants assemble to discuss the thing, and the outposts of the army of observation, principally boys, are pushed forward to Mr. Crook's window, which they closely invest. A policeman has already walked up to the room, and walked down again to the door, where he stands like a tower, only condescending to see the boys at his base occasionally. But whenever he does see them, they quail and fall back. Mrs. Perkins, who has not been for some weeks on speaking terms with Mrs. Piper in consequence for an unpleasantness originating in young Perkins having fetched young Piper a crack, renews her friendly intercourse on this auspicious occasion. The potboy at the corner, who is a privileged amateur, as possessing official knowledge of life, and having to deal with drunken men occasionally, exchanges confidential communications with the policeman, and has the appearance of an impregnable youth, unassailable by truncheons and unconfinable in station houses. People talk across the court out of window, and bareheaded scouts come hurrying in from Chancery Lane, to know what's the matter. The Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.